What's up, everyone? This is Emmanuel, and you're listening to Crypto Testers, the podcast focusing all things product in the crypto industry. In this episode, I talked to Thomas Heller, the global business director of F2 Pool, which is the largest Bitcoin mining pool in the world. We discuss how mining pools operate, whether they can be a threat to the security of blockchain networks, whether mining is profitable only for large-scale mining operations or also for small individual investors. And we discussed the halving and how it impacted the mining industry, as well as how he thought things would play out once there are no more block rewards paid out to miners. But before we jump into the show, I want to thank our sponsor, Bitwala. Bitwala is Germany's crypto flagship company. They offer users in Europe a full-fledged bank account, including deposit insurance and other things, as well as an integrated Bitcoin and Ethereum wallet. So using Bitwala, you can move your money seamlessly between your euros and your crypto. They keep on adding new features, such as their recently launched Bitcoin interest account, allowing users to earn interest on their Bitcoin. I highly recommend you check them out. I will post a link in the show notes. Hey, Thomas.
How are you?
Very good, very good. Yeah, I'm really excited to do this podcast with you. I think mining is really one of the sectors in the crypto industry that I know almost nothing about. Like normally when I do a podcast, I ask all these beginner questions just to make sure that my listeners can follow. But in this case, I'm genuinely a beginner myself. So yeah, looking forward to... Sorry?
It's going to be a lot of fun. And yeah, I've also been looking forward to it because I know you spend a lot of effort and time trying to educate people and onboard people into the space. And that's, I think, something that's very important. So I'm really happy to help out and just share some insights on the mining side.
Awesome. Yeah, so let's maybe start with you before we dive into mining. So you're Australian, but you live in China nowadays. Maybe you can share a bit about how you ended up there and how you got into mining.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm actually from Melbourne, Australia originally. And back in 2014, I moved abroad. I spent some time in Hong Kong and then in mainland China. Actually, my background's in the IT space, but I wanted to try something a little bit different. So when I moved to China in 2016, I pushed myself to actually pick up Mandarin Chinese. So that was an awesome adventure.
Respect. And
it's a tough language, but I have to say learning another language helps you open the eyes up to different cultures. And
for sure.
It's just great. So after that, I was luckily introduced to the founder of F2 Pool in 2018. We became friends. I had a strong interest in Bitcoin already, but I hadn't worked in the industry. And then at the end of that year, Wang Chun, he asked me if I wanted to come on board at F2 Pool, basically growing the overseas business, our biz dev team and our marketing team. So that was a very exciting opportunity. And then basically all of 2019, lots of travel, understanding mining, meeting mining farms, miners themselves, and trying to grow the company. So that's a little bit about me.
Cool. And since you spent so much time last year learning about mining, can you maybe explain what mining is and why it is so important for the security of blockchains? And maybe explain this to me as if I would be your mother or something, or someone that really, you know, has not much understanding of this topic.
Yeah, for sure. So all of these blockchains, what's special about them is that they need some form of decentralized consensus algorithm, which means a way to know what is real and what is not real. So we could say the transactions on the blockchain. So for Bitcoin, basically, there's different types of consensus algorithms: Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin. They all use proof of work. So what that actually means is there is millions of computers around the globe actually verifying the Bitcoin or the proof of work blockchain. So basically, in the Bitcoin's case, there is a block every 10 minutes on average, and inside that block is a number of transactions, transactions being people sending and receiving Bitcoin from each other. Now, the actual miners, they have to verify the block and actually mine the block. So this actual process is them basically solving an extremely difficult mathematical equation. And then there'll be one miner with one machine that actually finds the block, and actually that block is added to the Bitcoin blockchain. So it's a very complex mathematical based process, but it really solves as the underlying way that these blockchains are secured. So on the flip side, imagine you're keeping track of your own personal transactions in a spreadsheet. So you control the spreadsheet, you put in the data, it's just you. We could say it's centralized in the way that you can control it. But that is the beauty of these blockchains, and particularly Bitcoin, is that not a single entity or a single person can decide about these transactions. So all of these computers, all of these people throughout the world who are mining, they are the ones all in a decentralized manner helping to secure the Bitcoin and proof of work blockchain.
Right. So in an internal payment system, like PayPal, for example, it's basically just PayPal who need to check if a transaction that is sent from one PayPal customer to another is valid, basically. But in this network that's completely decentralized, this validation basically is executed by thousands of miners who are like individuals or companies, and they run these hashing algorithms to check if transactions are valid. And then one of them solves the equation and gets the Bitcoin reward, right?
That is exactly right. Exactly. Okay.
And I know that there are like two ways to mine Bitcoin, right? So one is you are on your own, you have your mining machines and you just do your own thing. Or the other alternative is that you connect your mining equipment to a pool of miners, which is called a mining pool. And I think your company, F2Pool, is the largest mining pool in the world, if I'm not wrong. Can you maybe explain what mining pools are and what is the benefit of joining a mining pool versus, you know, mining by myself?
Sure. So nowadays, the Bitcoin network itself has grown very large. And in the mining world, we describe that by hash rate. So right now there is more than 100 exahash per second securing the blockchain. So that's a lot of machines. So I don't have a number in front of me, but it would be millions of individual machines who were at the same time mining on the network. Now, the thing is, there's only one block every 10 minutes on average. So if you're mining with a single machine yourself, you're one in a few million chance of mining a block. It means you may never actually mine a block. So this is how the concept of mining pools came about. A mining pool, you could imagine, is a team of miners who are working together to solve each block. And then if one miner from that mining pool does mine the block, the entire mining pool will share out that Bitcoin reward from mining the block. Each Bitcoin block has a block reward of currently 6.25 BTC. As you've probably seen, every 4 years there's a halving, so that actual reward reduces every 4 years. The most recent one was in May of 2020, from 12.5 to 6.25. And there's also the transaction fee component. So that's also what the miners get. So nowadays, to have a real chance of mining a block, you need to join a mining pool. Unless you are very, very, very large, a very large mining farm, if you have, say, 1% or 2% of the whole network, 1 or 2 exahash, you could consider to mine solo, as we call it. But nowadays, at least for the last few months, every single block that's been mined on Bitcoin has been mined through a mining pool.
Wow. Okay. And so I heard this explanation before of having a bigger chance to actually get something by joining a pool. But intuitively, that didn't make sense to me because you only get rewards based on how much hashing power you contribute to the pool, right? So yeah. So theoretically, if you have one machine and you mine by yourself, there is a chance that you will never solve a single block. But by joining the pool, you're sure, and if that pool mines a block, you will definitely get at least a few cents or a few dollars because someone in your pool solved the block. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So okay. Let's do a quick example. Let's say you actually operate one machine right now. Let's say a MicroBT M20S machine, which is a popular machine. That's 68 terahash. There's many calculators online to tell you approximately how much would you earn for that much hash rate per day. So I've just pulled it up on f2pool.com. It's around $5.05 per day, 0.00055 BTC. So if you're a miner, you can join a mining pool and get approximately that much BTC every day. Of course, it will fluctuate over time with network difficulty going up or down. Versus if you just decide to do solo mining with that one Watts Miner machine, you know, I'd have to run through the numbers, but it might be one block every 16 years. So if you do mine that block, your windfall is going to be around $60,000 plus, because 6.25 BTC in the block reward and Bitcoin's around $9,000, $10,000. So you could take the risk and mine for 16 years and try and get one block and get that huge windfall. Mm-hmm. Or as most people do, miners, they have to pay operating expenses, right? They have to pay for electricity, facilities. So for them in general, it's much better to get a regular stable income, average it out over time.
Gotcha. Now, okay, that makes total sense. Now I understand that part. And so who are the miners joining your pool? Are they like small companies or individuals with one machine? Because I checked the F2Pool website before, and as you just mentioned, you have these calculators, and I saw that the good machines that are powerful and energy efficient, they cost between like $2,000 and $3,000, which is not prohibitively expensive for the individuals, but it's also not completely cheap. So assuming you make like $5 a day with your machine, you'd need like 1.5 years to break even. So is that even worth the effort for an individual with one machine, or do you really target like small companies with 100 machines or something?
It's a really interesting question, because this was one of the kind of myths that I was wondering about even, or just as I was joining F2Pool, because as someone who's been interested in Bitcoin for a couple of years, I was always curious about mining. Oh, is it a way that I can secure Bitcoin but also make some money for myself? So back then, when I didn't have the knowledge I have today, I just looked at the numbers and I was like, oh, you need a very cheap electricity price. The machines are quite expensive and network difficulty goes up. So it definitely seemed like it's just not a feasible way to get a profit. Now, the thing is, you asked who's actually joining the pool. So there is actually a number of ecosystems or market participants in mining. So you've definitely got the really large mining farms. Some of them are actually public companies in Europe or in the North American region. Basically, they take in public funds and then set up their operation. Or you have guys running their own mining farms, large mining farms with 5,000 machines, 500 machines who are doing privately run. But then you also get the individual. So as an individual, there's a few ways to mine. If it's in Bitcoin, you could theoretically buy one machine and you put it in someone else's mining facility, like a co-location facility. Basically, someone else sets up the farm and then basically you pay a hosting fee and you can mine with as little as one machine. And you mentioned the ROI period, the break-even period is quite long. So actually, you're very correct. We've had the halving just a couple months back, and that definitely squeezed the marginal mining profits more than ever before. A very useful metric to check this out is, what is the daily revenue per terahash per day? So right now for Bitcoin, it's around 7.4 cents. Pre-halving, it was around 10 cents, 12 cents. So you can see if your costs are all the same, but your revenue has decreased 30%, it's really going to make it very tough. So that's why the ROI period is a bit longer now. Before the halving, back in 2019, ROI periods at times could be 8 to 12 to 18 months, depending on the market conditions. But as you said, now it's definitely longer. It's 18 months plus.
Yeah, and I saw that when I used your calculator, I saw that it assumed an electricity cost of, I think it was half a dollar cent. And for example, in my country, in Germany, we have, I think, amongst the highest electricity prices in the world, we pay 30 euro cents for a kilowatt hour of electricity. So is it completely impossible to mine in Germany, or are there tricks that I don't know of to make this endeavor profitable?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So let me share a little bit about standard electricity prices. So firstly, now Bitcoin mining is so competitive that it's not like you can mine in a residential area with a residential electricity prices, basically anywhere in the world, okay? You basically have to get industrial rates, so you have to run it as a business. I'm not sure right now what the rates are in Germany for industrial level, but I could tell you that there is very little, if any, mining happening in Germany right now. Mm-hmm. In Europe, there's a number of large data centers and mining farms in places like Iceland, Norway, Sweden, as well as in Russia. So Norway, Sweden, and Iceland are very interesting because they use clean energy, hydropowered. Facilities are very professional. And what I mentioned before about electricity price and like hosting price, as an end customer, if you can put a machine in a facility around 4.5 cents, 5 cents, 5.5 cents, that's kind of, or even 6 cents, that's the kind of ballpark figures in Northern Europe. But it does differ globally. China, for example, that's one of the reasons why there's such a huge amount of network hash rate and mining in China is because of relatively cheap electricity prices. So comparing to the prices I just mentioned in China from the months of May to October during summer, you can get prices around 3, 3.5 cents. Whereas outside of that period, it's more like 5.5 cents. And then across the globe, there's many other interesting places. It's basically about finding a trade-off between good prices as well as the safety, the regulatory landscape, and the stability of the mining. So sure, you could go to a developing country where there's very cheap power, but maybe the regulation landscape is not so clear. There's a risk of you losing your machines. So would you rather that, or would you rather do it in more of an established, developed country that has the right regulatory system in place? So it's very interesting. But as someone in Germany, if you want to do mining, your best bet is to work with a professional company that provides these hosting or co-location services. And you can go to the farm, you can check it out, you can meet them, and then you do the numbers for yourself.
But that company or that data center would not be located in Germany itself, but rather in Iceland or some other country to make sure that you get exposure to these cheap electricity prices? Or are there even data centers in Germany?
I think right now I have not come across any large data centers operating inside of Germany. There's a few German companies who have their data centers in Scandinavia or Russia or Kazakhstan. So yes, you probably have to be open to the miners not being physically in Germany.
Yeah.
The one thing I do want to add on though, so we've been talking a lot about Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin is very specialized. You know, the machines we use, they're called ASICs. They only mine the SHA-256 algorithm. So say Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, or Bitcoin SV. But there's plenty of other proof of work currencies. As you know, let's say Ethereum or Grin. These coins can actually mine by GPU cards, so graphic cards. Mm-hmm. But apart from these currencies, there's plenty of smaller ones, like new projects that pop up over time. So actually, even in countries like Germany, where the electricity prices are a bit higher, there are people mining these more speculative currencies, mm-hmm. and they probably convert it to, say, Bitcoin or another coin. So I think there is some miners actually in Germany, but they're more on the smaller scale, most likely as hobbies or speculative mining.
But if you mine smaller coins, let's exclude Ethereum there, because I think it's a very well-established cryptocurrency by now, but these smaller coins, if you decide to mine them, do you also take some risk there, because some of these fluctuate a lot, and you know, you could basically invest into a machine there and then start mining, and then 2 weeks later the cryptocurrency that you decide to mine, let's say I don't know, Monero, completely random example, completely crashes and it's not really profitable to mine it anymore. Is that a risk? Or I mean, you mentioned that people can just like sell it immediately into another currency like Bitcoin as soon as they have earned some profit, but like going forward they would still need to stop mining it, so they would have some sunk costs, right?
Definitely a risk. And the coins we described, Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero, in my eyes, they're actually very established. Not as established as Bitcoin, but still very established. But even with those coins, there is more risk mining them compared to Bitcoin. Every currency, every cryptocurrency that we mine does have price risk. So even Bitcoin, there is a possibility, which we saw, say, in March, where the Bitcoin price dropped from 9K to 3, 4K. That was devastating for some miners. A lot of miners were able to like withstand it because it was just for a short period of time and now the price is up. But for some miners, it was devastating. Whereas Ethereum, Monero, all these other currencies, they're more volatile than Bitcoin, as we know. And actually, I was referring to even much more obscure currencies. So F2Pool right now, we support 50 proof of work currencies. There's hundreds. So I'm thinking more of the ones that either have just launched their mainnet. So a lot of people like to mine them when they're not so well known and to mine it as much as they can. But then there's plenty of others. Yeah. So definitely be careful of that. Even you switch instantly to Bitcoin every day when you get your payout, there's still the risk.
Yeah.
Yes.
But also there's one difference between the other proof of work currencies that we just mentioned, like Ethereum, Monero, etc., and Bitcoin, is that with a GPU machine you can mine any of these other coins. So if one coin is not profitable anymore, you can just switch, use the same machine to mine another coin. Whereas Bitcoin, because it's such a specialized hardware, you are stuck basically with that one currency. Is that correct?
You've got it spot on. And let me share something interesting with you. So the evolution of mining and what is used to mine the currencies is very interesting. So I think back in the early days, 2009, 2010, it was mostly CPU mined, and then CPU being in a computer.
Right.
And then over time, people started to use GPUs, so graphics cards, to even mine Bitcoin. I think that was back around 2010, 2011. GPUs, as you mentioned, are more flexible. They can mine different currencies. Whereas ASICs, which now the Bitcoin network is full of ASICs, these specialized machines, they can only mine one algorithm. So ASICs kind of in the Bitcoin network came about, I think, 2013 and onwards. So if you are a GPU miner, basically you can mine different currencies, which makes it very interesting, because you could have a kind of an algorithm in place which monitors price and network difficulty and block reward, and then to decide itself which coin to mine. You could switch between different coins. Actually, just F2Pool, we have two of these profit switching pools. One is for SHA-256 Bitcoin, and one is for Equihash, so which is Zcash and Horizon. So that is very interesting. And the GPU mining does give you more flexibility, as well as GPUs can be used for other things. Mm. People play video games, people need to do some kind of AI calculations or video rendering, they can still use a GPU card, they're not totally wasted. Mm.
And for your company, F2Pool, is it part of your service to also host these machines, or is that like other companies taking care of that? If I would, for example, buy a machine, but I don't want to take care of it, maintain it myself, could I give it to F2Pool and you guys take care of it and that machine automatically also joins your pool? Or is that two separate services? So I first need to find a data center and then via the data center, like connect it to the F2Pool?
They're two different services. We focus on the pool side. We just want to do as well as we can on that. We've been around for 6 years and that's our kind of bread and butter. But the thing is, the pool is so core to the industry. It's part of our strategy to make mining easier for our clients, no matter if they're small or large. We do have a page called f2pool.com/farms, where we've got a bunch of verified mining farms. So these companies are well-known companies in the industry, or we've worked with them before. So any user, any customer can go to this website, this page, and learn the details, the prices, the details about these farms, and contact them themselves. But of course, we will help out, because it's just, we want to make mining easy. And obviously, if mining is easy and people enjoy using F2Pool as a pool, then that's the best chance of retaining our kind of customer base.
And are there centralization dangers associated to mining pools? Because you mentioned before that nowadays most blocks, if not all, are mined by mining pools. I guess, I don't know how many there are, I think five or six really big ones. But how much power do mining pools have over the miners in their pools? What can they do? Can they censor transactions?
So in terms of mining pools, there's around 4 to 5 that are large, meaning have more than 10% of the Bitcoin network share. And then you've got about another 5 or 6 who I would say is medium-sized, meaning they have around 3% to 7% of the network share. And then you got a few others. So all in all, there's around 15 very active mining pools who mine blocks day to day. The mining pools do have an element of control, because once the computing power from these mining machines are submitted from the machine to the pool, technically speaking, the pool can decide which coin to mine. So for example, in the Bitcoin case, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV have the same mining algorithm. So if the pool wants to direct the hash rate to a particular coin without the customer's consent, it is doable. And there was some controversies with other pools in the past about doing that, but thankfully nowadays we don't see as much of that. And actually the pools now offer this as a service, being that if the customer opts in, the pool can choose to then what to mine. But we have to be realistic, and that is one kind of threat. I would say that one of the biggest things that does come up is that there's a few Chinese mining pools. So most of them are based in Beijing, and there's some concern that, you know, external actors could come in and force these mining pool owners to do something against the network. Okay, I hear this quite a bit. On the flip side, changing a mining pool is very straightforward. So on your mining device, you enter your username on the pool and you enter in the URL of the mining pool, a Stratum server, as we say. So to actually switch between pools, it takes a very short time, like seconds to minutes. So the thing is, if there was a mining pool that was doing malicious things, or if there was mining pools, as you said, like centralized or colluding together, it would be very fast for miners or people to identify this. Nowadays, there's so many companies doing on-chain analytics, looking at hash rates, looking at what's going on, that these pools would not be able to get away with it for a long time and people would change. So it does come up, but I don't see it as a major issue right now.
So there's actually a good reason for that. People don't store also their machines with you, because if all the machines of individuals would be stored with the mining pools, and the mining pools would either collude or be censored by the Chinese government or something, it would be the machines and the machines would be gone as well. Whereas now, even if the mining pools get censored or taken down, people still have their machine and they can just create a new pool or direct it to another already existing pool. So it's only a temporary attack, basically.
That's exactly right. The way I see it is similar to storing coins on an exchange. So I think it's very important that people are aware of their coins, their Bitcoins. Do they have access to the private key? Do they own those coins? But the reality is, there's times where we do want to store a small amount of coins on an exchange. Maybe we want to convert from Bitcoin to another coin. Maybe we get our mining rewards directly to the exchange, which I don't recommend. Better to send to your wallet. But people use exchanges. So it's all about minimizing your risk, even with the mining pools. The mining pools do daily payouts. Technically speaking, you could set it up so the payouts are done weekly or only if they reach a certain threshold. But what you're doing is you're letting the mining pool remain having custody of your coins. So in all cases, I see exchanges are crucial for the ecosystem. I see mining pools as crucial to the ecosystem. But as an individual, you should do what you can to minimize any risk. Minimizing the risk would mean store your coins in a wallet you control, put your hash rate to a pool that you believe in, that you think does the right thing for Bitcoin, but then get the payouts to your wallet. So you at least take out that risk away. And if you feel that any pool that you're using is doing something malicious to the network, then switch it away to another pool that you believe in. But it's particularly an interesting issue right now, because in the past 6-12 months, more and more exchanges have been getting into the mining pool business. First was Huobi, next was OKX, and now Binance in April this year. So I think it's very important that people remember where we came from in terms of why we're in Bitcoin. We're in Bitcoin because we believe in kind of financial independence, decentralized systems. So I definitely feel that people using an exchange and using that exchange to mine with a mining pool is a potential risk.
Mm-hmm. And what about transaction censoring? Is that something that a mining pool can theoretically do? Let's say I'm a big mining pool in the US and the US regulator comes to me, the mining pool owner, and tells me, like, this particular Bitcoin address, it's someone in Iran. I don't want that you process transactions to this particular address. Is that something a mining pool could enforce, or do the miners of the mining pool, can they decide themselves which transactions they put into a block?
So the short answer is yes, pools can prioritize transactions in a block. Now, there are some interesting developments. There's a company called Brains. They're working on an uplift to the protocol. The Stratum protocol is called Stratum V2. So that's kind of, they're working on that to kind of decentralize and improve the protocol and make it more secure. Apart from deciding which transactions go in the blocks, there was actually some interesting cases 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure if you saw. So there was, on the Ethereum network, there was two transactions with an extremely large fee associated with them. So it turns out that it's most likely a hacker and a blackmail attempt. Basically, they managed to like get all the owner's Ethereum and put it as the fee component, and then it was sent to the mining pool. So it's a very interesting case, because the mining pool can also theoretically decide if that is a transaction that should be kind of reversed or paid out to the miners. Sorry, I kind of misspoke. It's not that the transaction will be reversed, but it's like the mining pool is in the middle and can determine should the mining pool return the funds to the original account holder or distribute the funds to the miners. Yep. So it's a very interesting topic, because some people believe that the mining pool should not have any say about distributing the funds. They should just do it. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people say if there is a hack or something, that it should be returned. So it's very interesting. There was actually a third case, which F2Pool mined the block. The first two cases were unrelated to the third one. The third one was a hack as well, but a different address. And we were approached by the original owner of the funds, and they identified themselves. So we were stuck in a very interesting dilemma. I can't remember the amount. It was a few thousand Ethereum. We mined that block. Do we pay all these Ethereum to the miners, or do we return it back to the original owner? So after discussing with them and discussing internally, we sent back 90% to the original owner, because that was what we believed was the right thing to do. However, some people argued that we should have distributed the full amount to our miners instead. But it's a very interesting case.
How did you get... So I'm familiar with the first two transactions that you mentioned, but this one, so you got the transaction sent to your mining pool, basically, of a few thousand Ether that was put in as a fee component to a transaction. Yeah. Is that correct? Or was it, because you mentioned the word hack, so I wasn't sure if there was a hack involved.
Okay, so it's a little bit complicated. So basically the original owner of the funds, they got hacked. And basically the hacker added a few thousand Ethereum as the transaction fee of the transaction. So
okay.
As you know, the transaction fee either goes to the pool or it goes to the miners of the pool.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting case because for Ethereum, we run a pay per share and a pay per share plus pool. PPS, the first one, means that the pool keeps the transaction fees. PPS plus means that the miners of the pool take the transaction fees. Okay.
Yeah.
So by chance, it was mined by our PPS pool because these two pools have different fee structures. So people choose which one they want to use. Now, it was mined by our PPS pool. This actually means that F2 pool is the rightful owner of the funds because we don't pay the transaction fees from that pool.
Okay.
However, we didn't feel it's the right thing to do is to keep it for ourselves. And it was a very tricky one, right? Do we return it all back to the original owner? Do we distribute all to our miners? Or do we do some kind of hybrid? Luckily, the original owner was quite flexible and very happy that we were kind of wanting to return. So we returned 90% back to the owner and 10% we distributed to our miners. We wanted to try to find the most optimal solution.
Yeah, that's a good compromise.
Very tricky, though. Just one more thing. Because
yeah.
You probably saw the two other transactions that week that mm-hmm. was mined by Sparkpool and Ethermine, who are much larger transaction fee components,
mm-hmm.
Both of those pools decided to not return and both of them decided to distribute to the miners. I'm not here to say what is right and wrong. It's a very tricky situation, but simply because we did it differently, there was, it was just a very tricky one to work through.
I know there are a lot of speculations on what exactly happened there. I'm not exactly familiar with all of them, but my kind of crazy intuition was that someone of the who's part of the mining pool was the hacker themselves. So they would just send the money to the mining pool, knowing that the mining pool would distribute the money to all the members of their pool. And if that person was a very big part of that mining pool, they knew they would receive a big part of that, of the proceeds of the hack, basically, and in the same time wash the money in a sense. Is that completely crazy or is that a possibility?
So that is a very valid concern because at the early stage it was very unclear what's going on. The thing with this case is they have no way to guarantee which pool mines a block. So it still goes down a bit to chance. The other thing is, it seems like perhaps it was like a blackmail attempt. So that basically the hacker was saying, okay, just send over X funds and everything will be fine to the original owner, or they're just going to drain all the funds by sending us the transaction fees.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very possible. There was also some talk like, oh, maybe it's the mining pool themselves, right? Maybe the mining pool is sending to themselves and they're going to just keep the funds for themselves. So that's why we had to also prove that we did send it back, show the transaction and so forth. So very right. interesting and yeah. very tricky.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, okay. Let's shift gear a little bit and talk about the halving. You mentioned it before. But I think it's a topic that's worth discussing a bit more. So as we all know, I think the halving, every 4 years, the block rewards get halved. So the profits of the miners, basically. And yeah, if energy prices stay constant and if Bitcoin prices also stay constant, which has been the case in this scenario. Like in the last 5 or 6 months, the Bitcoin price has kind of hovered around $9,000 or $10,000. So then the halving of the block rewards is kind of a negative event for the Bitcoin miners. So can you share a bit of how it has affected the mining industry?
Yep, definitely. So we've had three halvings, but this halving in 2020 was the first one that kind of had widespread awareness. And comparing 2020 to 2016, in 2020, there's a significant number of large-scale miners with very serious operations and costs. Some of them are public companies and so forth. So definitely more impact this time. The primary impact is, as you said, the block reward is halved. So from 12.5 to 6.25 BTC. But that's a known event. So all of these miners pre-halving can anticipate the reduced block reward and the income after the halving. So what that meant was miners needed to really upgrade their operation. They had to evaluate post-halving, would they still be profitable? The main drivers are their electricity price and the efficiency of their machines. Now, upgrading is not a thing that you can do overnight. It takes planning. It depends on the market conditions. It depends on what machines you could buy. And of course, electricity, it's not like you can just suddenly find cheaper power. It's a long-term effort to continually try to negotiate a better power purchase agreement or to find locations with cheaper power. So definitely for, say, so the halving was on May 2020. For like the 6, 9, 12 months prior to that, people were preparing for the halving. There hasn't been too many cases of companies, miners having to exit the ecosystem, like big players, because of halving. I would say that guys that have S9s or guys that do not have the most competitive hosting or electricity prices, some of them definitely switched off machines. But you switch off machines, you sell them secondhand, and then you can always evaluate to get back into the space. So definitely it's just primarily a markets thing. One interesting thing after the halving or during at the halving and following the halving was the renewed interest in Bitcoin and a large number of transactions taking place. So the transaction fee of the block reward was actually really high for a period after halving, making up like 30% of the block reward. So imagine 6.25 BTC plus another 1 or 2 BTC.
Okay.
The other important thing is just at a network level is the network hash rate and difficulty. So in March, when we had the Black Thursday price drop on March 12 from 9K to 4K, the network hash rate also dropped from about 125 exahash down to around 90 exahash. You could actually imagine that was like a halving before the halving, because we could see which mining pools would drop the most and so forth. Because following that, the Bitcoin price rebounded and then we got to the halving, the revenue halved. So we saw a very similar series of events. The network hash rate dropped down to around 90 exahash. And now it's rebounding back to that 110.
The hash rate dropping, is that only a result of miners who are not profitable anymore post-halving, just dropping everything and leaving, you know, shutting off the equipment? Is that the only thing that makes the hash rate drop, or are there other factors?
So that's the main thing. So the network hash rate is basically just the combination, the aggregation of all the machines and all their hash rate combined. So another interesting metric to look at is kind of the cost to produce one BTC. So that's a very useful metric, because if, let's say, you're using an S9 machine and at your electricity price, your cost to produce one BTC is like $8,500. Now, if the Bitcoin price drops from 9,500 down to 8,000, you have gone from making a small profit every day on your machine to making a loss every day on your machine. So you have a decision. Do you wait it out? Do you just mine at a loss and hope the price goes up? Or do you switch off machines? So in most cases, the miners will switch off. They're hoping temporarily. And that's why we see the network hash rate drop. And then if the miner was thinking that it's going to stay down for a while, we're not competitive enough, they would have to consider selling their hardware.
Okay. And one question that I ask myself, I would like to hear your opinion on it. Do you think the Bitcoin network is, like, when I started to get interested in Bitcoin, the idea was sold that, you know, everyone could basically mine, and nowadays it's not the case anymore. As we just discussed, it's more like companies that take care of this task. So do you think it's bad for the Bitcoin network that this is shaping out like this, or do you think it's actually safe because, I don't know, companies are distributed over different continents, etc., etc.?
I think it's not a bad thing. because for any market, for any industry that grows, it kind of, the bigger players take over. The good news is, as we discussed earlier, you could still mine with one machine. You need to do some research. You need to meet with these co-location hosting facilities, but you can still buy one machine and put into the farm. And if all things go well, you've done the right research and the right kind of market analysis, you could run a profit, okay, even with one machine. I think that in general, it's a good thing because Bitcoin, the network has a large amount of hash rate securing it. If you compare it to, say, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV, those two coins have around just a couple percent of the hash rate that Bitcoin does. That's a big threat for those networks because there could be malicious actors from Bitcoin going over and do a 51% attack or other to those networks. So I definitely feel that more hash rate on Bitcoin is a good thing. And for that to happen, it obviously needs bigger players getting in. And also, along with just securing the network, when these large companies come into the space and secure the network, they're also doing other things. They're increasing adoption. They're getting the professional players in. Their institutions are coming in and looking at it, which I think overall is a great thing. One interesting thing that I will add as a potential risk is, so we talked about the network hash rate. So around 110, 115 exahash right now. Now, if there was something catastrophic in Bitcoin, and let's say the Bitcoin price dropped to $2,000, $3,000, and more than 50% of the machines were turned off and laying idle, well, because they're not profitable. Firstly, as we know, Bitcoin's network difficulty adjusts every 2016 blocks, every 2 weeks. So if machines turn off, it becomes easier to mine, and then the hash rate comes back online because it's more profitable. But the thing is, imagine if after the halving recently, like 60, 70% of the hash rate turned off. That would mean there's all these machines sitting around. They're not profitable to mine Bitcoin, but people may have the idea of using it for something else, like doing an attack on the network. I would say that's a risk that people don't talk about enough. And I'm not mentioning it today because I feel like it's very likely that to play out, but it's definitely something that is a potential risk in the future. Mm-hmm. Especially as every 4 years, there's the halving, right? So every 4 years, the reward component of the block reward halves. So it will rely more on the transaction fees. So that it's potential that there'll be more and more machines laying around idle. We'll see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. And you said you hope that more big players are going to, you know, join the mining industry and increase the hash rate. But let's assume the price of Bitcoin stays at the levels that it's at currently for another year or so. Like, is there any incentive for big players to actually, you know, join the mining industry, given that if they join, the hash rate would increase and it's becoming more difficult for every individual miner to make a profit, right? So it's kind of a zero sum game. It's one pie and the pie size doesn't increase. And the more people join, the less there is for each one of them. So is there an incentive for big players to come in and put money into this industry in the current state?
Everything you said is very accurate. So it is a very competitive game. I would say that there's still a number of players getting into mining recently or now with large mining operations. So the key part is, as a new entrant, you have to compare yourself to the average or the other participants in the industry. For one very clear example, if your electricity price is super low, or if you're in a place where what you're doing by having the mining farm can add value there and you get even potentially free power, then yes, you can be competitive. Mm-hmm. And then you can shake it up. Of course, this is very rare because if we could get cheap power, everyone wants to get cheap power. So there's just special cases. Recently, there's been a number of new mining farms being set up in Texas. Very cheap power, stable, good regulatory environment. So there's a number of large companies setting up right now, getting into the industry. And but not just Texas, also in other places. So if you have access to cheap power and you can kind of actually set up a facility, sure, you can still enter. But that makes it tough for everyone else because, as you said, it's a pie. If the pie doesn't get bigger, people are eating your pie. So it's always a battle to continually optimize your machines, your operations, your electricity price if you can. If you don't, you'll be left behind. So it's a hugely competitive industry. It's really, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen an industry where people are working 24/7 every day and just kind of, but it's not so like, it may sound very cutthroat. It may sound like everyone's like, it's like dog eat dog, but the beauty is people do find ways to work together. And then the last thing I'll add in is that's part of the reason why all of us, we need to educate people at Bitcoin. That's why I like your website, because you're doing your part to help people know about Bitcoin, about cryptocurrencies. And the more people that know about it, find value in it, it's better for everyone.
Definitely. Yeah, that's why I started the website. You're absolutely right. One last thing I wanted to ask, or actually two things. So how do you think will the mining industry look like once there are no more block rewards? And I know this in a long time. I don't even remember exactly. Is it 2040 that the last like block reward, like that there's basically no more block rewards per block? It's only transaction fees. So, or is it later? I'm not entirely sure right now.
It's 2140. So okay. Still got a long time.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's a very interesting question. Basically right now, each block has 6.25 Bitcoin plus the transaction fees. Okay, I'm just pulling up the transaction fees right now to see how much that makes up right now. Mm-hmm. It's around 0.2. Okay, so each block is around 6.45 BTC. The thing is, some people predicted that after the previous halving, May 2020, there would be something like a death spiral. A death spiral is a kind of a common myth in the industry, or actually more so by people not in the mining industry, saying that Bitcoin price goes down or difficulty goes up, then miners will turn off, like so many miners will turn off. And because every miner turns off, no blocks are mined, and then the network's going to die. Okay, that's a very common kind of misconception. But what we found at the halving in May 2020 was just a road bump. 30% of the hash rate turned off. It's not a surprise. People know it's coming. People adapt. For the future, it will be very interesting. So we're at 6.25 right now. Like next will be 3.1 and then 1.55. So it would probably be the coming halving in 2024 won't be a super crunch point, but I think the one following that will, because the transaction fees would make up such a significant component on the block reward. I mean, obviously the idea is that over time, the Bitcoin network gets adopted more and those transaction fees make up a greater component. What I feel is everything will play out. The market will play out. If it's profitable to mine, more miners will mine. If it's not profitable, some miners will turn off and we will continue for people to find cheaper power. Getting to the point where there'll be places where you're operating at nearly zero cost for electricity potentially. So the risk would be if something suddenly happens. The good thing is we know what's going to happen every 4 years during the halving. So we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm. The easiest solution is that the Bitcoin price increases, right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Okay. It's a very interesting one because pre-halving, the recent halving, everyone was saying, not everyone, some people were saying the price of Bitcoin is going to double. It doesn't work like that because there's many like forces in the industry and nothing can be predicted like that. In general, myself, I'm very bullish long-term about Bitcoin as something we use, but I also am bullish about the price. So I think we basically in 2017, we just saw a huge amount of retail action, just like I don't even know what the word is. It was just crazy, right? I think that was like out of the natural order of things. But if you look year to year, right now we're at 10K and more people are using Bitcoin. So we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah. My colleague, he has this idea that in a long time, if Bitcoin is really adopted, it could even be And let's say transaction fees don't make up for all the costs of mining. It could even be like businesses that operate in the crypto industry, let's say exchanges that, you know, set up mining farms just to and see it as an operational cost, because they depend on their business depends on the Bitcoin network. And even if they don't generate any business from the mining themselves, it's still important that the Bitcoin network exists. So they just see it as like, yeah, as an operational cost. But I'm not entirely sure what to think of that, or if that's realistic.
It's definitely possible. It really depends on how widespread Bitcoin becomes. Also, it depends on the future of just the world, how everything will go. We may see that even something like exchanges, these centralized exchanges, are seen as a negative thing, maybe, right? Maybe some negative things will happen in the future. Then the most logical way to get Bitcoin is to actually mine it. It's the most pure way. So we may find that Bitcoin gets adopted much more, and maybe it's even hard to get Bitcoin. So then maybe you do want to mine at a loss because Bitcoin becomes that such core element in society. Yeah. I think definitely for the next couple of years, at least the next 4 years, right? It's just going to be more of the same. People are going to, for the mining side, people are going to be trying to buy newer machines, cheaper power, do things like using custom firmware, using innovative immersion cooling, all these kind of incremental innovations and optimizations.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's impossible to predict because there are so many variables that go into that and they could all change. It's only interesting to think about it and to play out different scenarios, but impossible to predict. Okay, last question, because we're well over an hour now, but what are your thoughts on proof of stake? So proof of stake, just for the listeners, it's a new consensus algorithm that Ethereum, the second largest cryptocurrency network after Bitcoin, is going to switch to and is more powerful, processes more transactions and works different than proof of work. So people who stakers don't have to own like very expensive hardware, but they just have to basically contribute or stake their coins and then vote on transactions. And it's said that this is way more energy efficient, but I would like to know what you think about that and how the mining industry looks on proof of stake. Is it a threat maybe, or is it an opportunity?
Yes. So it's not a threat. Firstly, my of course, F2Pool supports like 50 currencies, but personally, I'm a big fan of Bitcoin. I think it's great. We have various cryptocurrencies and various projects, but for me, I'm very focused on Bitcoin. And at least for Bitcoin, it'll be proof of work. If it's not proof of work, it's not Bitcoin. So it's not a threat in that way. Ethereum, as we know, is transitioning to 2.0, which is proof of stake, but it's a huge monumental effort to get there. Now, one of the common negatives about proof of work is that it does use a lot of energy and it's not good for the environment. Just one thing on this point is that a huge percentage of mining farms are powered by clean, green energy. There's a report by CoinShares, which they do every 6 months, which is really cool.
Yeah.
They kind of analyze renewable energy's usage for Bitcoin mining. So that's one key point. Now, for me, the most important thing is the security of the protocol. Whichever consensus algorithm can maintain that. I wouldn't say I'm negative to proof of stake, but I think proof of stake is unproven. I think one of the main things with proof of stake is that it's the people who hold the coin are able to stake the coins and are able to earn more coins. So you could almost say it's the richer getting richer. Whereas with Bitcoin, it's kind of that element is abstracted out because you could be a Bitcoin hodler, you could be a Bitcoin miner, you could be a Bitcoin dev, you could be one of these different kind of personas. Whereas in proof of stake, it's almost like the staking component, those people may be the same as the hodlers, right? So there's potential risk of the rich getting richer, But again, it's my main concern is just it's unproven. So with Bitcoin, we've had 10 plus years of success, growth, a reliable network that doesn't go down. It will be interesting to see how Ethereum goes. With Ethereum, I often get asked, what will happen to all the Ethereum miners? So there's GPU miners and ASIC miners on Ethereum. Basically, there's also an Ethereum Classic. There was a fork a few years ago. Some of those miners, because it's the same algorithm, will go to mine Ethereum Classic. Some of those miners will, with their GPUs, just mine other coins. People ask me, will those miners for Ethereum just start staking Ethereum? Probably not the miners themselves, because those miners are operating a data center with machines doing these transactions. They will continue to do that. Mining pools, on the other hand, will support Ethereum. So some of them, so F2 pool, we have another team doing staking. It's called stake.fish. Some of the other mining pools are also doing some kind of staking. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Absolutely, yeah. And then as a last point, I think, like, because you mentioned the richer with proof of stake, the rich will keep become richer. I think, the stake is 32 ETH, so it's not that much money, but there's also already similar attempts to like staking pools where people can pool their assets together to form 32 ETH, so they can then stake together, basically. But yeah, as you said, it's in preparation, but definitely interesting how it would play out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Thomas, thank you very much for all these explanations. I learned a lot, and I hope the listeners have as well. Is there anything you want to share or finish with?
Well, it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed chatting. And basically, if anyone has any questions about mining, I'm always very willing to kind of chat. And I think the most important thing is we keep remembering why we're in Bitcoin or crypto and do our best to support in any way we can.
Hey, I hope you liked this episode and learned something new. In case you did, please feel free to share it with your friends and family or reach out to us on Twitter. Also, we'd highly appreciate if you'd follow it in your podcast app or give it a rating. And hope to see you soon for a new episode.